Hello again, friends, and welcome to episode 4 of our Talk Sports podcast, Adventures in the Art of Lively Conversation. I'm your host, Gary Sabinski, and I'm joined as usual by my good friend and sidekick, Roscoe, master of the witty turn of phrase and storyteller extraordinaire. At times, is it as is typical with our program?
At times,
yeah.
It meaning sometimes I'm not that interesting.
Sometimes you're not extraordinaire.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Always interesting.
All right.
And always an artist. As is typical with our program, today we're going to be discussing a wide range of general cultural interests and goings-on around Chicago and the world. And I guarantee we won't be taking the advice of Henry Higgins to Eliza to stick to two topics, the weather and your health. However, I'd like to start with those. Good day, Roscoe.
Good day.
How's your health these days?
My health is okay. My neck has been bothering me, my shoulder's been bothering me, my knees have been bothering me. But I went to the doctor and I went to physical therapist, and to a physical therapist. So much for the art of lively conversation. we don't know how to conjugate verbs.
Yeah. I didn't say we were linguists.
No, we're not linguists.
We're conversationalists.
Yeah.
But you and I were both suffering from la grippe. Last time on our podcast,
yes.
And I feel almost 100%.
Well, spring is almost here. Can spring be far behind?
How was your Easter?
What was Easter?
I think you came here on Easter, didn't you?
I did come here.
Didn't we have an Easter egg hunt?
Oh, I came here for you. Yes, we had an Easter egg hunt, which I found irritating because I don't enjoy things like that.
Why you were irritated was because you could not find the very last one.
I could not find
them. And you kept quizzing me. I felt like I was under some sort of SS interrogation. You kept asking me questions, and I kept saying, I'm not going to give you any more hints.
You said they were
other
all
than
in plain sight.
It's all in plain sight. It wasn't in plain sight.
But didn't you do something? You did something evil, like you put it in the next. It was in plain sight of it. It was in another room.
It wasn't in another room. It was in that plant that you just didn't even, you decided not to even look in. This is why you were irritated. That's the point.
I have issues with Easter egg hunts, and I'll tell you why. When I was in kindergarten, there was an Easter egg hunt at the public library in Niles, Michigan, and a photograph was taken of me crawling under a bush to find an Easter egg. And so the picture that appeared on the front page of the Niles Daily Star was a photograph of my hind end crawling under a bush trying to find an Easter egg. And I've never quite recovered from that.
Other than that, you're feeling well. I'm going to touch back on our previous episode where we went to the Chicago Flower and Garden Show, sponsored by Mariano's. And in one segment, you were deluged by salespeople trying to sell you consoles. And in case anybody doesn't remember, you eventually wound up buying a pair. How are those working out for you a couple of weeks later?
They have changed my life.
Really?
I spent $30 for these flimsy-looking, you know, they're not thick at all. They're an eighth of an inch thick, filled with magic fluid. Is that what they said? Magic fluid, imported gel, something. With sparkles in them. I feel like a 16-year-old. I could go to a sock hop tomorrow. No matter what pair of shoe, every morning I have a ritual where I try to find the shoes that I wore yesterday. I dig out my consoles. I shove them back into the shoes I'm going to wear today. And it's like walking on water. It's like walking on the Sea of Galilee or something.
The best $30 you ever spent.
It's the best $30 I ever spent. And sometimes I'll go to the Walgreens. I'll go to a drugstore and I'll look at their gel-filled insoles. Not the same thing.
Mm-mm.
Not the same thing. They also don't sell them in a size 14.
Have you had occasion to go to the console's website and check out, you know, their series of products and how you can get replacements for these?
No. I
have not.
I should just buy a whole bunch of them. Then I wouldn't have this, you know, clawing them out of my shoes every morning.
You could have a pair in every pair of shoes.
Yeah. But they're amazing. And, you're never really stepping on a hard surface. Everything you step on has this layer of mushy glitter-filled gel.
Speaking of glitter-filled gel, you didn't order a G-Swing by any chance.
I did not order a G-Swing.
It would look great in your apartment, just in that corner by the windows.
Well, I'm thinking of getting rid of my couch and just putting a G-Swing in.
I think that would be wonderful.
Yeah.
You'd probably have a lot of visitors. You know what I mean?
people with bad backs seeking relief or...
Or bad knees. You know, I just had knee surgery.
You did.
In fact, you can still see the scars and the taping on it, and it was arthroscopic on my right knee. Not that our listeners need to know what knee, but for a frame of reference. But
well, because you just had surgery on your left knee.
That was about 7 months ago, and it's right as rain. And my right one started to act up in very much the same way. And doctor said, well, you know, these things happen when you get to be your age. You know, your knees start to go. Thank you.
Thank you. That makes me feel a lot better.
Makes me feel a lot better. And so I had this one done, and it was a week ago on Friday, and virtually no pain any longer. I still have a little range of movement, but I wish I had some consoles to wear.
I begged you to part with $30, and I said, and those poor men worked so hard. Can you imagine a life on the road where you do nothing but drive from one circus tent to another trying to get people to buy these insoles and convince them there's something better than they can get at the drugstore?
What do you talk?
It's a hard way to make a living. You know,
He's
an insole man. And he sells magic souls to the boys in the band. and the shiftless unemployed men who have nothing to do on a Wednesday afternoon but wander through the garden and flower show at Navy Pier.
That would have been us.
It was us.
Speaking of Meredith Wilson.
Yes, Meredith Wilson.
You've had a recent cultural experience, and we haven't touched on this yet because it just happened last night, but I want to hear what your thoughts are. You, once again, were our eyes and ears at the Lyric at Large. Roscoe at the Lyric at Large. And I want to hear what you thought. You went to see...
I saw Carousel. Hammerstein's highly acclaimed, famous 1945 musical, which is being given a production at the Lyric Opera House. Lyric Opera House here in Chicago is doing 5 Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals over the course of 5 years. This is the third year, I think. They still have to do The King and I, and...
I don't know.
Cinderella. Probably not Allegro.
Flower Drum Song.
Ooh, Flower Drum Song?
Could be. I don't know. They haven't announced. They have announced King and I for next year.
Mm.
But I don't know what the
fifth one is. Well, last night was Carousel, and I have to tell you, this production has gotten largely very enthusiastic reviews. People have been very excited about it. But there's always been a little bit of quibble. You know, one review will say that Stephen Pasquale, he's a handsome man, 38, he was in The Bridges of Madison County last year on Broadway, which ran a month. And so some of the reviews say that he's revelatory, he's thrilling, what a voice, oh my God. And then you'll read the Chicago Tribune and they'll say, well, you know, he's like 80% there. He's not quite all the way. Or the reader said that he never believed his connection with the leading woman, so the whole musical falls apart if you don't believe they really love each other. In another review said, this is an instantly legendary production. So I couldn't wait to see this. I got a ticket in the 8th row center, which in the Lyric Opera really matters, because if you're not on the main floor and you're in one of the balconies, you might as well be 2 blocks away with binoculars.
And you got this ticket at virtually the last minute, right? You got calling up the box office.
A week before. I'd rather not give away my secrets on the air about how I procured this inexpensive ticket.
Well, we're not on the air. We're on a podcast, but it's
well,
okay.
Well, people are listening. I don't know if I tell everyone else how I did this, they'll do it too, and then I won't be able to anymore.
Fair enough. Your secret is safe with me.
All right. Perhaps I'll share it in a future podcast. But I just don't feel like it right now, Gary. Is that okay?
It's fine.
I'm so worried. I'm starting to sweat now thinking
about it. Do you want a Kleenex? You look like you're tearing up.
Well, I'm getting a little... I have to tell you about my emotional moment. Can I just tell you about the end of the show last night? The end of the show last night, when Billy crosses the stage to tell Julie that he's always loved her, I do this thing now where I don't get teary-eyed. I start sobbing. So my body began to become racked with sobs, and I tried to stop myself. So in trying not to sob, I choked, and then I coughed, which made me choke more. So then my eyes began to water in addition to crying. And because I was choking, coughing, and crying, the woman next to me, I believe, began to worry that I was having a small series of seizures in my seat during the last moments of the play. So it kind of threw me and everyone off. But so let me back up. Carousel, Lyric Opera, Stephen Pasquale, Laura Osnes. She's the big new thing in, on Broadway. She just starred in Cinderella. She was the replacement in South Pacific a few years ago. She was Bonnie and Bonnie and Clyde the musical, which lasted all of 30 performances.
Also a poster up at Joe Allen.
Yes, and I saw that production, and she's great. Tony Roberts. Tony Roberts is in the show for
Crazy.
5 minutes.
The Starkeeper.
And Tony Roberts, of course, we know from his brilliant production number in the 1968 Tony Awards, from the number from How Now Dow Jones, where they had an idea in the late 60s when everything was counterculture that you just couldn't do anything as you normally did. So they thought, let's do a chorus where all of the women are unattractive and overweight and too short, too tall, too big. Well, the net effect of this is it's grotesque. It's the worst production number ever in the history of the planet.
And it's a parade. It's a parade style thing.
Kindly step to the rear. Terrible production number. So here all these years later is Tony Roberts. And Tony Roberts was in Annie Hall, played against him, many Woody Allen movies. Tiny role. Who else is in it? Denise Graves, the famous opera singer, Denise Graves. You'll Never Walk Alone. So quite a cast. So last week, as the Lyric Opera always does, one of the early performances of the show was broadcast live on WFMT radio. So I remember this out doing something else, and I thought, oh, you have to run home and listen to this because you're so excited about seeing Carousel at the Lyric Opera. So I run home. The only radio that I have that functions is my shower radio, which costs $20 and is a transistor radio with a speaker about 2 inches big. I have a nice stereo system, but when I set it up, I threw away the FM antenna accidentally, so I've never been able to listen to FM radio. So I'm listening to, I get to listen to Act Two of Carousel on my little toy radio, and it's pretty thrilling. It's pretty thrilling, but it's a toy radio. But something, there's a clue here. This should have been foreshadowing. And I understand you're trying to mic a live broadcast, so you can't have 4,000 mics out there. It's the gigantic opera house. So a number will sound thrilling to me, and the number ends, and then there's a delayed response, and you hear the audience. But the audience sounds very far away, and their reaction is muted to what's happening on stage. So it's like, why aren't people cheering? Why, you know, they don't sound like they're up for grabs. They're not hearing the same thing I'm hearing. So I'm taking too long to get there. I go to the show last night. It's exciting. People, you can tell people are there for an event. I've never seen people so, you know, people actually dressed up to go to see a show. And if there were people in blue jeans, at least they were expensive blue jeans and they were wearing a sports coat. I sit down, the show starts, the first number begins, and the women are talking like this, and they'll say, "Hi, Julie, 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 Julie. Oh, it's so good to see you, Carrie, 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 Carrie." The sound design is horrible. I have never thought about this. I've never anticipated this. I never worried about this. But these are Broadway-trained actors performing in a 3,000-seat opera house, which is cavernous. You know, I can't overstate how cavernous this theater is. I'm in the eighth row, and I must have been 100 feet from the stage because there's a gigantic orchestra pit. So there's no way around it. Everyone has to be mic'd. But, you know, it's not 1943. It's 2015. Have some miking and some amplification so I can hear these people.
You know, it's an interesting point you bring up. I was listening to a broadcast from WQXR, which is sort of the WFMT of New York, and this very, very smart woman who does a weekly broadcast. Her topic was, should Broadway musicals be performed on the opera stage? And a great deal of her framework for, it wasn't criticism, it was just topical conversation, was, you know, the opera houses were designed to be sung in without amplification. You don't amplify the opera singers in a regular performance at the Lyric, for instance. They just sing to the back row, because that's what they're trained to do. So when you start putting Broadway type singers with not quite as full of voices, and you need to mic them because so many people are talking or singing or doing something at the same time, and there's so much dialogue that has to be picked up in order for the plot points to proceed, it becomes a big challenge on how do you electronically enforce the voice in a space that's not meant to be electronically amplified into. And it's you know, the purists will say, well, they shouldn't be. We shouldn't be doing Broadway musicals. Or if we do, we should just do them with opera singers because they're the ones who can fill the house. So it's interesting for me to hear that you felt that the sound design was really substandard.
Well, I'm not sure they can fix it.
And you've seen many Broadway musicals.
But, you know, not in that horrible cavernous theater. You know, I was thinking, you know, when I was a child, I saw Angela Lansbury and Gypsy there. Maybe my hearing was better 40 years ago. But I don't remember sitting in the theater being obsessed with the fact that the sound design was bad. The worst was Carrie, who I think just was told that the microphone would do all the work. So she's kind of breathy and sort of talks like this, and you never can really understand anything she says. Then you have Denise Graves, the mezzo-soprano who has appeared in opera houses all over the country. So at the beginning of the second act, Denise Graves has what's supposed to be a funny throwaway line, where a normal person on stage would say, gee, I sure wish I didn't have those last four dozen clams. Denise Graves goes, I sure wish I hadn't had those last four dozen clams. A legitimate opera singer, Denise Graves could sing on that stage without a microphone. She's forced to be mic'd because everyone else is mic'd. And her big number, You'll Never Walk Alone, excruciating.
In what way?
Well, I looked this up after. She's only 51, but I think her voice is shot. She's singing at the very top of her range. You can tell that she's using every ounce of support that she has. There's this incredible warble to her voice, and you just worry that at some point it was going to rip into shreds. So, high points.
Despite all of that, okay. Clearly you were emotionally affected by the end of the show, and it's an emotional
By the very end of the show, but I have to tell you, for the first 45 minutes, I was so gosh darn angry about the sound, and so disappointed and mortified that it took me a long time to get over. And I the rest, the audience was there. They wanted to love the show and they really leaned into the show and wanted to enjoy it. Very hard to understand it. Very hard. The women, I will tell you, the two women with all of the beautiful songs never made any impression on me because you couldn't understand the lyrics. They couldn't fill the space with their voices.
Hmm.
Stephen Pasquale at the end of Act One does the famous soliloquy. Thrilling. But he walks to the lip of the stage and sings he's all but screaming. And he's thrilling because he has the pipes and the audience goes nuts. Goes nuts. They must have applauded for 3 minutes. And I kept thinking, if only the rest of the show were at this level, this would be the most thrilling thing that I've ever seen.
Before we get to some of your other comments, and especially high points about the show, let's talk about the history of Carousel for just a few minutes.
Right.
And I'm sure you have some information about that. As you mentioned at the very top, 1945, it was Rodgers and Hammerstein's second show after the huge success of Oklahoma. It's based on a French play by Fénèque Molnar, called Lilium, also was a film in the silent era, I believe, right?
An early, there were actually four versions, early versions of it, of the film. And the most famous is a French version with Charles Boyer. I just tried to rewatch this. Excruciating is a word I'm using too much today, but a very difficult to watch 1930 version with Charles Farrell.
I've seen that one.
Yes, we've seen it together. And Hobart, Rose Hobart. And I looked her up recently, and they said that one of the problems with her as an actor is that she came off as kind of weird and bizarre on screen, which is actually true. So you have a woman, an actress on screen, and her motivation is to fill a pitcher with water, but there seem to be 20 different things going on in her head.
When it was first produced, it was not well received as a play.
Mm-hmm.
But on subsequent...
The original play, 1903.
But on subsequent productions, especially when it premiered in Budapest, it was a wild success.
Right.
So I guess perceptions and mores had changed. It confused the audience at first, apparently. But it was... was the material that Richard Rodgers kind of latched onto as possibly his next project, and they had a difficult time deciding because Molnar was notorious for not letting any other adaptations of his work be done. He didn't want to give away the rights, and he didn't understand the American musical theater at that point. Well, who did? Yeah. It was a fairly new genre. Anyway, as you said, 1945, the original Billy was John Raitt, who they had found in California, brought him to New York, actually, to audition as the takeover for Curly in Oklahoma.
Oh.
And liked him so much, even after his warm-up piece, which I think was a piece, was an operatic.
It was. Piece. They were all trained opera singers.
And they loved him so much that they immediately said, well, I think we need to use him in our new show. The hell with putting him in the old show. He had subsequently then appeared in Oklahoma as well. Jan Clayton was the original Julie, and she was a minor MGM film star at that point, but also a fairly well-trained actress. Both of those roles had been have been done by numerous very well-regarded theater and film folk. In fact, Howard Keel and Barbara Cook are a famous pair that did the show in 1957. In fact, Barbara Cook not only played Carrie once in 54, but she went on to play Julie in 1957 in the revival.
Wow.
In New York. 1965, John Raitt came back to revise the role in New York. I think at New York Opera. It might have been at New York Opera. I'm not exactly sure of that. But do you know who played Enoch Snow in that production?
No.
Red Skelton.
No.
Yeah, it was John.
What year?
1965.
Wow.
It was John Raitt and Red Skelton as Enoch Snow, Edward Everett Horton of Fracture Fairy Tales fame,
wow.
and of early
talkies. Yeah.
He was in a number of movies with Fred Astaire and those slapstick comedies. He played the star catcher. It was his last role. And Jerry Orbach played Jigger.
Jerry Orbach.
His ne'er-do-well sidekick friend, bad guy on the waterfront. But the show was beautifully received from the very beginning. It had some trouble out of town, but all those things do. But I think they fixed it in New Haven. And when it opened on in New York, huge success, ran for 890 performances or something like that. There is a story of Richard Rodgers having had injured his back during the last week of previews, and he had to be propped up on a stretcher in one of the house boxes, and he really couldn't see the audience, but he could see the stage. And at the end of the play, opening night, he did not really hear much of the audience reaction, much like that tepid reaction you heard on WFMD. And of course, he was very despondent about that until immediately afterwards, his friends and well-wishers were gushing as to how wonderful it was. He realized he just couldn't hear the applause because he was behind this big curtain. His daughter, Mary Rodgers, was in the audience, and she remembers looking over and seeing her childhood friend, Stephen Sondheim, watching the play at the end and sobbing uncontrollably at the ending. It subsequently closed in New York and went on tour in America for a couple of years and even played five sold-out months in Chicago.
Wow.
You know, Never Walk Alone, by the way, was one of Irving Berlin's favorite songs. He always likened it to the 23rd Psalm. He said, listening to that song is like listening to the 23rd Psalm for me. I thought
Irving Berlin said that?
Irving Berlin once said that.
Well, our producer asked me earlier if I might sing a snatch of You'll Never Walk Alone.
Please don't.
Would you like to do it? She wanted me to illustrate the point of Denise Graves' warble, but I'm not sure that I'm...
Let me just finish mentioning in 1963...
Oh, no one ever lets me sing.
Well, when we have the money for you to be singing on the radio, then we'll let you sing.
All
but
right.
At this point, I can't pay you.
You can't? Oh.
In 1963, there was a British group called Gary and the Pacemakers. Perhaps you've heard of Gary.
Oh, sure.
A number of number one hits. And one of their big number one hits was You'll Never Walk Alone. And that was brought to them by their then manager, Brian Epstein. In Liverpool, Brian Epstein went on to be the longtime manager of the Beatles.
Sure.
And so this was a big number one hit. Liverpool was famous at that point for really loving the American musical theater. They played their songs all the time in various venues and sporting events at the Liverpool Football Club, which is still a very famous soccer team, football team in Liverpool. They would play the top 10 hits during their halftimes, and one of their favorite songs of all time was You'll Never Walk Alone. And to this day, the gated arch over the entrance to the Liverpool Football Club says, You'll Never Walk Alone.
Wow.
It's become sort of their theme motto.
Really?
You know, originally, that Starcatcher was played by two characters, Mr. and Mrs. God, who appeared as sort of New England farmers, kind of like
American
Gothic.
Okay.
And it was inexplicably weird to the preview audiences out of town. So I think they wisely changed it to a you know, an all-knowing, all-seeing star catcher guy who is not necessarily God, but represented, was God's representative up in the heavens. Interesting piece of rewriting.
Yeah. Very attentive crowd, very polite. They now allow beverages and plastic bottles of water into the theater. There's no escaping this.
Have to do it. It's an economic thing.
So I had a woman in front of me, and I felt bad for her. She had a tall man in front of her. So for the entire show, she's looking over his right shoulder, then looking over his left shoulder, then looking over his right shoulder. And then every goddamn time there was a musical number in the second act, she had to bend over, try to find her plastic water bottle and take a big swig of water in the middle of the number. And she was just far enough away. If she'd been directly in front of me, I could have leaned over to her and said, stop that. But she wasn't directly in front of me. She was four people over. So during the reap, during You Never Walk Alone, she's bouncing around looking for the water bottle. Oh, here's the water bottle. Crinkle, 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 put back on floor. Then at the very end of the show, you know, Julie, I've always loved you. If I loved you, oh, let me find my water bottle now. Crinkle, 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 glug, glug. Time and again, I would try to say all I wanted to. Screw the lid back on. Oh, put it on the floor. Oh, wow, it's going to slide down the floor. He's like, wait, think. Are you thinking? Are you conscious of the noise you're making? This woman is driving me crazy. And I tried to get her after the show because I wanted to go up to her and I said, do you realize that every time someone sang, you had to go digging for your water bottle and gulping water? What's wrong with you? Stay home. So
there's your lyric experience in a nutshell.
Yeah, and I will say at the end, the audience stood and cheered.
A large and long nutshell, but a
large and long nutshell. The audience stood and cheered and cheered and cheered, and I think we had to. It's a Saturday night. We dragged ourselves downtown. Traffic was horrible. There was a Bulls game down the street. People paid $200 to sit on the main floor to watch a show that they couldn't hear.
Speaking of the musical theater, let's touch briefly on some things that opened, because it's springtime in New York.
Yes.
Many shows have opened. We've talked about a few of them in previews, and we've talked about some advance notices or advance comments on things. How about those American in Paris reviews, for instance?
I was stunned. Well, we should probably also back up and say that something like 10 musicals have opened or will open within a few weeks of each other in New York. And we thought the least of which was American in Paris, but talk about what you read about it.
Well, I did not read a single notice that was being kind to the book or to the plotting of the show. However, everyone that I read, Variety, New York Times, the Daily News, a couple of out-of-town newspapers, they all thought that this is an extremely entertaining, eye-popping, fun-filled, dance-filled evening not to be missed.
And the leading man is supposed to be a great dancer, we see with the American Ballet Theater.
Yes.
Everyone knew he was a great dancer. No one knew he could also sing and also was a hell of an actor.
Yeah, and it's brought the whole ballet form of dancing back to Broadway.
Yeah.
We haven't seen that in a while.
No.
I'm glad to hear it. A couple of podcasts ago, we were ruining it because of some early notices
right.
that we had read. But it sounds like they went ahead and kind of fixed those problems and figured out how to do it. It's a novice Broadway musical director, although he is world famous in the ballet choreographer world, Christopher Wheeldon. But this is his first Broadway musical, so I'm sure that they all sat down and they figured out how this could best work. Gigi, the reviews for Gigi came out.
Yeah.
What did you think?
Whoa. You know, that wasn't a good... The movie. Have we talked about this on the podcast before?
No.
The movie is unwatchable now because of its subject matter. You know, this man grooming a young 15-year-old girl to become a prostitute, basically. You know, it's distasteful. It's creepy. You have old man Maurice Chevalier singing, "Thank Heaven for Little Girls," which is creepy. And... it's a musical that I can't watch. There was a disastrous stage production 25 years ago, 1973, in New York. So let's have a revival of the disastrous stage production. And the reviews were pretty unkind.
Finding Neverland opened.
Oh.
The J.M. Barrie making Peter Pan play.
Is there any show you've ever wanted to see less in your life?
It does not thrill me. Yeah. No. Harvey Weinstein's behind this.
Yeah.
Because of the movie.
Yeah, so if I end up in the trunk of a car with a bullet hole in my head, you'll know why. Harvey Weinstein's gotten to me for bad-mouthing the show on a podcast. A
couple of closings have been announced. Mamma Mia is finally closing
on Broadway.
God. That was sort of my feeling. Enough said. We'll move on to that. Here's something that made me very sad. The Fantastics is closing again.
Closing again. At the Snapple Theater.
After 18,000 some odd performances or something like that. I saw this show as a child in my formative years when I was seeing things in my formative years at the Candlelight Dinner Playhouse in Summit, Illinois. it's a small musical. It's five actors playing multiple roles of varying things. Jerry Orbach was the original El Gallo.
Was it thrilling to you as a child?
Thrilling.
I cannot wait
to be in this show. I cannot wait to do these songs. I cannot wait.
Took you?
My parents. It was always my parents. We'd go for, we'd go for the dinner theater.
Was that how your love of theater started?
It is how my love of theater started, along with the original cast albums that my parents bought that were always in our house. Sometimes they'd go to New York to see a couple of things, or they'd see them when they were here in Chicago. But my mom was a big theater lover. Mm. They always had cast albums in the house of everything. I had original cast albums of all of these shows. So it saddens me that the Fantastics is once again closing. But once again, it's going to reopen. Someone's going to find new life.
You never let me talk. Could I throw something in here? You were talking about Liverpool and their love of Broadway musicals.
Indeed.
Do you remember that on one of the Beatles' first albums, they sing "Till There Was You" from The Music Man?
Indeed, they do.
Yeah. So you have the Beatles is all original music. Forever, and then inexplicably, they're singing "Till There Was You."
A rhythmic love all around, but I never heard it singing. No, I never heard it at all till there was you. It's a beautiful
rendition. And that's by Meredith Wilson.
It is from Music
Who you mentioned earlier as you were introducing Carnival.
We were walking down the street. We were walking down the street the other day, coming from dinner right here in our neighborhood, and we're passing this group of. Couple of fathers and their young daughters, they must have come from either soccer practice or something. And one young girl, maybe she was 9, she's holding her father's hand and swinging his hand, and she's got little shorts on. And she's singing. And I could see and hear that she's singing as they're approaching us down the sidewalk. As she gets closer, I could hear her sing, "There's no business like show business."
No.
And she sings all the lyrics as she goes by us. She's singing some verse. Clearly, she's either in the chorus or they're doing "Annie, Get Your Gun" somewhere at her high school.
That's hilarious.
These things happen all the time. I run into them all the time. I want to ask you about something that's close and dear to my heart, as you know, and I wonder if you've heard any advance word about this. Dr. Zhivago on Broadway.
Yes.
I don't like the sound of that.
Well, this is what I read last night, and this is from a Broadway chat group. So these are largely embittered people who go to plays by themselves, and then they go home, turn on their computers, and while drinking glasses of wine, t- type acrimoniously into their keypads. So what I heard, some people, I guess it's a small section of the story, because of course, you know, Dr. Zhivago, if you put the whole thing on stage, would be 48 hours long. So it's a small section of the story, and it's a lot of bombastic American Idol type music where they're hollering. And so people have been crabby about that. But I understand the male lead, he's supposed to be quite powerful.
So that's interesting.
Where are we?
It's
where
interesting you should say this about Dr. Zhivago and people sitting around typing bitter acrimony into their computers after they go on. I've been feeling very much absorbed by this idea of people looking for the worst things in the world or seeing the worst things about something. And more specifically, deriving some sort of pleasure out of the misfortunes of others. Why is it that we will talk about, well, let's say Broadway shows we've been talking about. We're as thrilled about the show that's a gigantic success and is just the greatest thing we've ever seen as we are by the show that spends $2 million on and closes on opening night. Mm-hmm. The Germans have a word for it. It's called Schadenfreude. And again, it's the pleasure derived from the misfortunes of others. The word is taken from, it's German, and it literally means harm joy. And it's the feeling of joy or pleasure when one sees another fail or suffer misfortune. And it's borrowed from some other languages. An English word of similar meaning is gloat. That means to feel or express great, often malicious pleasure or self-satisfaction at one's own success or at another's failure, or even especially at another person's tragedy. And it leads me to a segment that I want to explore with you a bit, because I know you know an awful lot about this. Why are we so attracted to Hollywood tragedies? I want to touch on one that has a particular sentiment for me, and it's because she's associated with a movie that I just love, and you'll recognize this immediately. Susan Peters.
Oh, Susan Peters.
Poor Susan Peters.
Susan Peters. You and I and no one else in podcast land knows who Susan Peters
well,
is.
Well, Susan Peters was a young ingenue stage actress who migrated into the film. She was born in 1921 in Spokane, Washington, and her father was killed in a car accident early in her life, and the family moved to Los Angeles to live with her maternal grandmother. While a senior at Hollywood High School, she began taking drama classes, and she signed with an agent, and after graduating, she won a scholarship to the Max Reinhardt School of Dramatic Arts, which was also quite popular there. And performing in showcases, and she was spotted by a talent scout for Warner Brothers, who were always trying to look out for those things. She began her career with the given name of Suzanne Carnahan and played small, uncredited parts in such films as, well, she was in Meet John Doe, but uncredited. Here's why I love her. Her first substantial role was in a film in 1942 called Random Harvest.
Ronald Coleman, Greer Garson.
Thank you very much. And she earned an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actress. She did not win for that part. But she played Kitty, who was a young sort of, May-November romance with Ronald Coleman. Mm-hmm. He falls in love with her. She's like a second or third cousin or something. And once he comes back from his, amnesiac journey, it's a long, long, very involved plot, which I'm not going to get into now. Anyway, she's in this, and she's quite beautiful and quite striking in the whole picture. But she eventually married actor and film director Richard Quine in 1943. A little side note about Richard Quine. He was a stage, film, and radio actor who began as a child in radio, vaudeville, and in stage productions. There's something you don't hear every day. I began as a child actor in vaudeville.
In vaudeville. Wouldn't you love to be able to say you were in vaudeville?
Why don't you say that? I think you should put that in your bio.
Yes, that's why I only go by my first name, Roscoe. It's to hide my tragic vaudevillian past.
I would say you were born in a trunk, but I
was, you know, I went
the trunk of a car, maybe.
The trunk of a car.
He signed with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer in his early 20s, and his acting career began to wane after World War II. So he began working as a film director and later moved into producing and directing television and directed several well-known films, including Bell Book and Candle. The World of Susie Wong,
really?
Paris When It Sizzles, How to Murder Your Wife, and The Prisoner of Zenda. At any rate, here's where the weird Schadenfreude thing kind of begins to kick in. On January 1st, 1945, that's just 2 years after they were married, Peters and Quine were duck hunting. When a rifle accidentally discharged and she was injured, the bullet lodged in her spinal cord. The accident left her permanently paralyzed from the waist down, which required her to use a wheelchair. Her mother, who had maintained a bedside vigil during her stay in the hospital, died in December of 1945. So, you know, a little bit
of a broken heart, probably.
No doubt. MGM continued to pay her salary, but unable to find suitable projects, Peters subsequently left the studio.
Yeah, let me ask you, if you're paralyzed... I just want to point something out. So she was paralyzed from the waist down and forced to use a wheelchair.
What sort of roles are available to you? Peters and her husband adopted a son, though they separated in 1947 with Peters claiming that Quine was cruel. It would not speak to her for days. They were divorced in September 48 following her divorce and the end of her career.
Oh, my God.
Peters suffered from depression.
No kidding.
In 1952, Peters died at Memorial Hospital in Visalia, California, at the age of 31.
Ugh.
Peters' doctor attributed her death to chronic kidney infection, a complication caused by her paralysis. He also noted that her death was hastened by dehydration and starvation because in the last few weeks of her life, Peters had lost interest in eating and drinking and had lost the will to live. There's a lot of stories about people like this, and we should be appalled and saddened, as I am, but I'm also thrilled in some bizarre way, in a Schadenfreude way, to read about these kinds of things.
Yeah, but you're not happy that this happened to her.
It is.
I think Schadenfreude is like when I read that Liza Minnelli's in rehab for the eighth time, and I'm like, of course, you know.
Of course. That's not Schadenfreude. It's the pleasure derived from the misfortunes of others. And somehow...
But I'm not are you taking pleasure from Susan Peters?
In some way, I'm taking pleasure from reading the story of Susan Peters. Not necessarily that I'm taking pleasure in what has happened to her. Let's talk about someone who also had a very kind of tragic ending. And maybe this isn't Schadenfreude, but you're very, very versed in this. And I thought I'd give you a chance to maybe show off some of your expertise. There's a film
actress. I can see her picture upside down. I know where you're headed.
There's a film actress from the 20s who was born in 1906, died in 47. So again, not an awfully long life. And began her career during the silent era. She was nicknamed the Joy Girl. And known for her jet black hair and overall beauty. This is an actress named Olive Borden. Most of our listeners will not have any clue as to what Olive Borden was, who was Olive Borden. However, you have a great sort of personal history with Olive Borden, at least
do.
In your life. So,
and I will tell you, if anyone has listening has been to the Chinese Theater in L.A., in Hollywood, and has walked down that sidewalk, you've encountered Olive Borden. Olive Borden was a California girl who was beautiful and exotic. She had dark black hair, gigantic teeth, and she got into the movies in the mid-20s and in shorts and comedy roles, and then became a leading lady at Fox. And this was a distinction I didn't know. You were never a star until you were billed above the title. So if the movie was Fig Leaves with Olive Borden, you were just a Olive Borden was just a leading lady. She was never a star. So she had a few good years. She was very beautiful. They would put her in front of the camera for any reason. So in the 20s, something they did to promote stars is, and people often communicated with postcards. So you'd give away postcards for free. You'd slap a movie star's picture on the cover. Olive Borden must have had her picture taken 5,000 times in a 2-year period because the number of postcards you can find with Olive Borden photographs on the front is amazing. So she was a leading lady with Fox, never demonstrated that she could carry a picture on her own that people would go to see an Olive Borden movie. The Depression hits, Fox cuts everyone's salary. They say to Olive Borden, "We're paying you $2,000 a week, we're going to cut it down to $1,500." She said no. Sound comes in. She and many other people just had no idea. How do you suddenly talk in front of a camera? How do you project your voice to the microphone? how do you relate to the audience? You know, were you talking to the actors? Are you talking to the people on screen? So what talkies of hers do exist are excruciating, and she has no idea what she's doing. Neither does anyone else. So what happened is she, her career ended very suddenly. She became something of a booze hound. She married a man who wasn't in the business, and then it turned out he was already married to someone. So then her second advent of fame was Olive Borden, bigamist, splashed all over the papers. And then she, and this is something interesting. Years ago, someone got an introduction for me to someone at the Museum of Modern Art who had the key for all the files on all the movie stars that they had in their film research section. So you could go there and look at the Lillian Gish file, and it would be an eighth of an inch thick. I asked for the Olive Borden file. Apparently, there was some Roscoe-like person who kept a copious scrapbook on Olive Borden, and then at some point passed away or entered old age and mailed pages and pages and pages and pages and pages of clippings that he had kept on Olive Borden to the Museum of Modern Art, which are in this file that I find that documents her entire rise and fall and tragic last years. So she, there was a film company that decided they would do in Florida what everyone else was doing in Hollywood. What they hadn't accounted for was they didn't know what they were doing. They barely knew how to turn on a camera. And the reason people didn't make movies in the sunlight of hot Florida in the winter is because of the goddamn mosquitoes. So every time they tried to make a movie, they would be overwhelmed with insects and rats and could barely stand it. So only three films were ever made by this company that before it went out of business. And one of them was her last film, Chloe, Your Love is Calling. Somehow, Olive Borden's mother ended up working in a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles, taking care of the poor and downtrodden who had come to L.A. to try to make it in the movies and had failed. And then one day, who walks in but her daughter, Olive? And she died basically of cirrhosis at the age of 41. And that was the end of Olive Borden. And by then, 1947, you know, her career was, she'd made her last movie 14 years earlier, just 14, but completely forgotten. Yeah. But let me give you the epilogue here. Years later, when they started the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and there was a lot of controversy about the Hollywood Walk of Fame because businesses didn't want their sidewalks torn up. When they finally got the green light to do it, there were 1,500 names submitted for people who deserve to have their stars on the Walk of Fame. They drew 8 names at random. One of those 8 names was Olive Borden. So she has a star at the corner of Hollywood and Highland, right in front of the complex where the Academy Awards are held every year.
6801 Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah. And so tens of thousands of people walk by her star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. She has prime real estate on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. So that's her happy ending.
It's her happy ending, and one that I know that is close to your heart. Who knows why people's stories affect us the way they do, and this particular woman's story affected you in some particular way, and you've grasped onto it. Your knowledge and passion for her life and her work are absolutely notable, and it's always fun to listen to you talk about that. Kind of leads us into our segment traditionally of
Kiss
of Death.
This is my favorite segment, Kiss of Death.
Is it your favorite segment? Do you know who Rudolph Purs is?
No.
Rudolph Purs.
Was, I'm guessing.
You're guessing correctly. Died at 89 recently, an advertising executive who pondered a soulless, squishy, cylindrical mixture of flour and water on his kitchen table 50 years ago and conjured up one of the most iconic images in all of advertising. Any idea what I'm talking about?
Play-Doh.
Very close. Rudolph Purs invented the Pillsbury Doughboy.
Really?
No kidding. The pudgy Pillsbury mascot known as Poppin' Fresh. Did you know his name was Poppin' Fresh?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, became instantly recognized as the symbol of the company's line of refrigerated biscuit roll and cookie dough and popped out of a cardboard tube. Poppin' Fresh made his debut in a 1965 commercial for Crescent Rolls. Within 3 years, the figure supporting a kerchief and a toque, you know, a chef's hat, and always tickled by a signature tummy poke, claimed an 87% brand recognition.
Oh, my Lord.
That's among American consumers. That was enough to immortalize him into the pantheon of other anthropomorphic hucksters, including the Jolly Green Giant, Tony the Tiger, and Morris the Cat, all part of our lexicon. Mr. Purs, who lived in Glenview, Illinois, just not far from here, was the creative director of the Leo Burnett Agency in Chicago, where he imagined a blue-eyed, Poppin' Fresh springing from the tube of dough like a fast-forward version of evolution from primordial ingredients. To distinguish him from a plumper incarnation of Casper the Friendly Ghost in cartoon illustrations, the Doughboy became a three-dimensional clay figure designed by Milt Schaefer, an animator. It's claimed that we made two Doughboys. One was a rubber Doughboy with an armature inside, and you could move his arms a little bit at a time, and the other was a hard Doughboy. When you ran them together, it looked very pliable. General Mills, Pillsbury's parents, said the first Doughboy television commercial required 5 bodies and 15 heads and cost $16,000 to make. 30 seconds of Poppin' Fresh on camera required 720 photographs. Mr. Purs worked for J. Walter Thompson in Chicago on the 7-Up and Aunt Jemima accounts and joined Leo Burnett as a copy supervisor in the television and film department in 1959. Poppin' Fresh has appeared in more than 600 different commercials. 600 commercials.
He's still on the air, right?
Yeah, he is. I just saw him the other day. And the most recent, he wears jeans.
And when is this, 50 years ago?
Yeah, 50 years ago. Oh. In the most recent, he wears jeans, presumably relaxed fit. He has guest starred in advertisements for MasterCard and Geico. Mr. Purs's work will be featured in, this is interesting, we might be able to, we should go to this. Mr. Purs's work will be featured in A Salute to Advertising's Greatest Icons, an exhibition opening in May at the Chicago Museum of Broadcasting.
Wow.
We might be able to go to that. I think that would be fun. Along with
us. We should take our
indeed, we should
there.
Do maybe a remote from the Chicago Museum of Broadcasting Communications. Write that down, Mrs. Producer. Along with Starkist's Charlie the Tuna and Keebler Elves and more. And Purs was a creative icon who created another icon, said Bruce DeMont, the museum's president. So that's my... that's my fun-loving kiss of death for tonight.
Wow.
Creator of the Pillsbury Doughboy. Emily DeBreda Phillips. Any idea who she was?
Emily DeBreda?
DeBreda.
No.
You wouldn't know.
No.
Emily DeBreda Phillips, she died on the 25th of March of this year. She was an elementary school teacher. She wrote her own obituary.
Really?
So after her death, she wanted to have it published. It says... I just want to read a little bit of this because it's really quite interesting. Why don't we all do this? It pains me to admit it, but apparently I have passed away. Everyone told me it would happen one day, but that's simply not something I want to hear, much less experience. Once again, I didn't get things my way. That's been the story of my life all my life. Memories. Where do I begin? Well, I remember Mother wearing an apron. I remember Daddy calling square dances. I remember my older sister pushing me off a tricycle on the cinder driveway. I remember my younger sister sleepwalking out of the house. I remember grandmother Nani, who sewed exquisite dresses for me when I was little. I remember my grandmother wringing a chicken's neck so we could have Sunday dinner. I remember taking the bride in our Tom Thumb wedding in first grade, being the bride in our Tom Thumb wedding in first grade, and performing skits for the 4-H Club later in fifth grade. I remember representing Waynesville in the Miss North Carolina pageant, and yes, I twirled my baton to the tune of Dixie. It could have been no other way. I married the man of my dreams, tall, dark, and handsome. Our plan was to have 2 children, a boy and a girl. Inexplicably, we were successful in doing exactly that when we were blessed with our daughters, Bonnie, and later on, our son, Scott. This might be a good time to mend some fences, she says. I apologize for making sweet Bonnie wear no-frills jeans when she was little and for redshirting Scott in kindergarten. Apparently, each of these things was humiliating to them, but both were able to rise above their shame and become very successful adults. I'd also like to apologize for Marianne for tearing up her paper dolls and to Betsy for dating a guy she had a crush on. Those were her two sisters. Just when I thought I was too old to fall in love again, I became a grandmother and my five grand angels stole not only my heart, but also spent most of my money. I've been a devoted daughter, an energetic teenager, a WCU graduate, a loving wife, a comforting mother, a dedicated teacher, a true and loyal friend, and a spoiling grandmother. And if you don't believe me, just ask me. Oh, wait, I'm afraid it's too late for that. Sorry. So I was born, I blinked, and it was over. No buildings named after me, no monuments erected in my honor. I did have the chance to know and love each and every friend as well as all my family members. How much more blessed can a person be? So in the end, remember, do your best, follow your arrow, and make something amazing out of your life. Oh, and never stop smiling. If you want to, you can look for me in the evening sunset or with the earliest spring daffodils. I love daffodils. My favorite flower, that's a side note, or amongst the flitting and fluttering butterflies. You know I'll be there in one form or another. Of course, that will probably comfort some while antagonizing others, but you know me, that's what I do. Today I am happy and I am dancing, probably naked. Love you forever.
Oh. Does it really say that?
I swear. Remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about the fifth oldest person in the world passing away?
No, we've lost the fourth oldest person.
The oldest person in the world has died at 117. Mm. A Japanese woman died Wednesday, a few weeks after celebrating her 117th birthday. Masao Akawa died of heart failure, stopped breathing as relatives and nursing home workers stood by her side and praised her for achieving a long, healthy life. Can't you just see that scene in a Japanese nursing home where they would just be... so it much in celebration of her life and not in such mourning.
There was no Schadenfreude there.
Not at all. Okawa, born in Osaka on March 5th, 1898. That's very close to your birthday, not in years, but day-wise. Was recognized as the oldest person in the world by Guinness World Records in 2013. A 116-year-old American woman, Gertrude Weaver of Arkansas, is now the world's oldest person. Wow. According to Los Angeles-based Gerontology Research Group, which keeps records of supercentenarians. She was born on July 4th, 1898. Okawa, the daughter of a kimono maker, said at her recent birthday celebration that her life seemed rather short. Asked for the secret of her longevity, she responded nonchalantly, "I wonder about that, too." Usually they have some advice, you know. A cup of tea, a lot of swearing, and loving your husband is usually the thing. Mm-hmm. Japan's oldest person now is a 115-year-old Tokyo woman, according to the Ministry of Health and Labor and Welfare. Japan has the most, and you probably know this, has the most centenarians in the world, more than 58,000 people.
What?
58,000 people are 100 years older or more in Japan, according to the government, and about 87% of them are women.
Wow.
Lastly, and, you know, I think I'm going to change a little tradition here and make this sort of a combination of Kiss of Death and Ross's Nobody Ever Lets Me Talk. A woman died recently in England. And I think this would be extremely appropriate for possibly you to read.
You're going to let me read it? Wow.
I think I'm going to let you read that.
Oh, boy, I'm doing a cold reading on camera.
It's quite all right. Pay no attention to those markups on there. I just thought there were things that could be skipped. But you're welcome to read as you want to.
Yeah, and before I read this, this is fresh off the presses. This is dated Sunday, April 19th. The New York Times obituaries. Not only is the subject matter and the content thrilling, but it's so well written, and this is an unusual first name. Margalit Fox is the writer of this obituary. Vivian Nicholson, rags to riches to rags icon, dies at 79. She went to London to collect her prize, wearing borrowed stockings and cardboard in the soles of her shoes. There, as flashbulbs exploded, she became an international celebrity, the factory worker who'd come into a fortune. Vivian Nicholson was just 25 when in 1961, she and her husband, Keith, won the Littlewoods Pools, a sports betting enterprise centering on British football, soccer in American parlance. The mother of four young children, 25 years old, four young children, she worked in a licorice factory in Castleford, a West Yorkshire town. Her husband was a miner. The rags to riches to rags story of Mrs. Nicholson, who died on April 11th at 79, made headlines around the world. The press trumpeted the lavish life that ensued and the precipitous and its precipitous end as a cautionary fable worthy of Aesop. Mr. Nicholson was killed a few years later at the wheel of the powder blue Jaguar he had bought with the prize money. Miss Nicholson wound up nearly destitute. At the time of their win, the Nicholsons earned £9 a week between them, not much more than $250 today. But after they correctly predicted the outcome of 8 football matches, they found themselves in possession of more than £150,000, the equivalent today of about $4.5 million.
Wow.
Yeah. They had to borrow the 5 shillings it cost to place their bet. Mrs. Nicholson, widely known as Viv, remained a picaresque figure of the British tabloids ever after, combining the looks of a gangster's moll with the larger-than-life temperament of Auntie Mame. As fate buffeted her to and fro, she incited in readers successive waves of envy, censoriousness, schadenfreude. I can't say it. Schadenfreude. Did I say it right?
Schadenfreude.
Schadenfreude.
Speaking of.
Schadenfreude. Speaking of schadenfreude. It all comes back to schadenfreude. Maybe that should be the name of our show. Schadenfreude with Gary and Roscoe. And ultimately, awestruck admiration for her indomitable mane. Over the years, as was avidly reported, she owned an elegant home, a fleet of automobiles, and wardrobes bursting with furs, shoes, and haute couture. She divorced 2 husbands and outlived 3 more, battled alcoholism, attempted suicide, moved to Malta to escape the tabloids, was deported from Malta after punching a policewoman in a fit of pique, which made the tabloids, was the subject of an autobiography, a BBC television special, and a West End musical, all titled Spend, 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 made a second bonanza from royalties and lost them too, descended into bankruptcy and subsisted on a modest state pension, had a career as a timorous stripper, was featured on the cover of Smith's single, Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now, became a Jehovah's Witness, was disciplined at her nursing home for rambunctiousness, for rambunctious behavior, and had remarkably few regrets. Born and reared in penury, at work in the coal fields at 12, and a bride before she was out of her teens, Mrs. Nicholson would be forever identified with the 3-word imperative that burst from her lips on September 27th, 1961, the day she appeared in London to collect her winnings. When a reporter asked her what she planned to do with the money, she cried joyously, "Spend, spend, spend." And so from that day forward, she spent, spent, spent. Vivian Asprey was born in Castleford on April 3rd, 1936, a daughter of a large family of an alcoholic miner and his wife. After winning the Littlewoods pools, the Nicholson bought a house in an upscale community, furs, jewels, and clothes, a gold watch, expensive perfume, a pony, tickets for overseas travel, boarding school educations for their children, and a good deal else. Most conspicuously, they bought cars. The fact that Mrs. Nicholson did not know how to drive was no impediment. And before long, she was roaring through Castleford, a down-at-the-heels mining town, in a vast pink Cadillac with the top down. Mrs. Nicholson took pains to wear an outfit that matched whatever car she was driving. Sometimes she bought the outfit to match the car, and sometimes she bought the car to match the outfit, her son said. And whether those cars were pink, green, or any other hue, her beehive hairdo was likewise dyed to match. She went to work in a Manchester strip club, divesting to the strains of Big Spender, but was fired after she refused to part company with her bra and panties. This is probably the greatest obituary I've ever read. By the 1970s, she was back in Castleford bankrupt. She later spent a decade as a saleswoman in a perfume shop. In old age, Mrs. Nicholson resided in a Castleford nursing home, where the British news media reported. The management took her to task for hanging her lacy lingerie in full view of the washing line and for shimmying down the drain pipe to visit local shops where she bought wine and chocolates for her fellow residents. It was not the spending she regretted, Mrs. Nicholson said. It was not the accumulations of consumer goods, but instead the loss of something far less tangible she had possessed long before. Winning the pool wasn't lucky, she told the Evening Standard of London in 1999. Before that, Keith and I used to have 5 cigarettes to last us all week. See, he would have a drag and give it to me, and I would have a drag. And I'd not eat much at dinner because we couldn't afford it. She added, sharing cigarettes, just holding one another and loving one another, that was when I had everything. What a great obituary. So well written.
Well written.
What yeah. a great life.
An interesting life. What would you do if you won that kind of money?
I'd do exactly the same thing. I would get a big Cadillac. I'd get a big Cadillac convertible, and I'd drive up and down Lakeshore Drive until they wanted to kiss my ass. And then I'd end up working at a perfume shop for the last 10 years of my life, probably in a wheelchair that I bought from the estate of Jean Peters.
Would you buy all clothes that match the color of your Cadillac?
Yes, yes. And dye your hair? And dye my hair.
Brilliant. This is exactly the kind of well-written piece that I look for, and sometimes they come up and sometimes they don't. Thank you for reading that today. It's beautifully constructed, and it's done with just enough love and mockingness mm-hmm. that you really get a sense of this woman's life. What a story.
Yeah, it's a great story.
Rags to riches to rags mm. icon.
It brings up a lot of questions for me.
Such as?
What happened to the kids? Did the kids go to boarding school?
Here's why this is such a well-written obituary, and that's just one of the reasons. They don't get into the whole kids thing and what happened to them, and there's brief descriptions of the ex-husbands. It's really just about Viv
yeah,
and her life,
yeah.
which is why it's so beautifully written.
I guess I just wanted to know the kids turned out okay.
Well, we all want to know the backstory, and that's why they make Google. But in a piece that's like this, where she gets 4 column inches to print something, I think she got right to the heart of who
this
absolutely,
person was. Oh, absolutely.
Really well done. Well, that's about all the time we have for our podcast today. We're happy that you tuned in and hope you enjoyed yourself as we flitter to and fro on subject after subject. Roscoe, as always, it's been a pleasure. You were delightful, sparkling entertainment today.
Was I? It was thrilling to be, you know, it's always thrilling to spend some time with you, Gary.
That's so nice. Why don't we have some pot roast?
Are you making a pot roast right
now? I think I'm going to make a pot roast.
Oh, you make the best pot roast. And I don't get a home-cooked meal unless you cook for me.
Let's have a pot roast.
It's one diner dive after another for me.
We'll have the pot roast and we'll download on this whole session. So thanks again for tuning in. This has been Talk Sports for another episode. And we'll see you all on the podcast airways next time.